Everyone has a story. I get them to tell it. Welcome to the Aaron Bender Podcast. Conversations with media personalities about their personal and professional lives and journeys. Thanks for all your support, all your encouragement. Really appreciate the 5 out of 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and all the positive reviews. Every subscribe, every rate and review helps spread the word. The more listens and shares, the more people will want to come on to share their stories with you, share their stories with me. And the more that I get to share my story with you, how many times can I say share in stories? Let's just move on. Before we get to my conversation with author and Fox 11 meteorologist Maria Quiban, a little about my story. I'm a widowed dad of 2 girls who just lost their mom, a grieving husband, a man in recovery trying to reconnect with the world with fresh eyes, faith, and perspective, a college journalism professor, a white guy in a world of injustice, a 20-year broadcast media veteran who had his dream job and then lost it. A year and a half ago, God gave me a gift, an opportunity to stop, step back, and breathe so I could learn about love, vulnerability, forgiveness, grace, self-care, patience, and understanding. Maria Quiban is the morning meteorologist on Fox 11's Good Day LA. We first talked in 2016, just a few months after her husband Sean died of brain cancer. Maria's just come out with a book, You Can't Do It Alone, A Widow's Journey Through Loss, Grief, and Life After. It's helped me a lot get through these last few months since my wife died. Maria will be doing book signings as the pandemic restrictions are lifted. Please follow her on social media at Maria's Earth. Maria's story starts with the first decade of her life in the Philippines.
We immigrated to Hawaii when I was 10, not too long after my birth father died. I was seven and a half.
What did he die of?
So my dad got into a boating accident with his brothers. They were all on the boat. There were 4 brothers on the boat. 2 of them died. 2 of them survived. It's funny how life can prepare you for something in the future. It's really interesting, isn't it? How that works that way.
When you had to call back to that, mm-hmm. A few decades later, what did you draw from that?
So much, actually, so much. I was not too much older than my son, Gus, when Sean, my husband, his daddy, was diagnosed with cancer and died 18 months later. So I remember vividly those moments when we found out that my dad had gotten into an accident, that he died. My mother was very young. I think that was the difference. And so I was terrified. I think my brother and I were both very scared about our future. And I think that was the main thing we wanted to do with Gus, was make sure that he would never feel any fear or be confused about what was going on.
What kinds of conversations do you remember your mom having with you when you were just 7 years old?
Very little. She was young, as I said. She was only 20. I want to say she was 27, 26 maybe. She was quite young. So she just didn't have the tools that we do now. The language to explain to young children what a cancer diagnosis is, what death is, what sudden death is, and what life after would look like. So we didn't have any of those talks, really. So I think in some ways it affected me differently from my brother, who was younger than me even. And Sean and I had long talks about that. And so our first and foremost concern was for Gus. And so we sought therapy right away for all of us as a family.
Before we get into your life with Sean, talks with Gus in those 18 months after Sean's diagnosis and when he died, we'll of course be getting into the book, You Can't Do It Alone, A Widow's Journey Through Loss, Grief, and Life After. I want to talk about that move from the Philippines to Hawaii. How did you feel about that move, and what was life like for you in Hawaii?
By the time we were going to move, my mom had talked to us about a new life, a different kind of life. And I think we were all ready for something different. We had been grieving my father's death. Things were different. Life was so different after he died. And so the prospect and the idea of moving to Hawaii, to move to the U.S., which as you know, represented so much more if you are from a different country. So for me as a young girl, I thought, oh, we're moving to America. And I honestly, we spoke English actually in Cebu. My grandfather, my mother is half white, and so she's half Caucasian. And so my grandfather always spoke English. We all pretty much always spoke English in the house. So that was a natural transition for us.
Before you move on from that, I'd like to address that, because prior to my meeting my wife, I honestly did not, and this is my ignorance and my bias, my American bias coming out here. I honestly just figured that once she and her family moved to the U.S., that's when they learned English. And and she's like, no, you don't understand. We learn English alongside Tagalog, and we actually are better speakers than many of the Americans we befriend once we got here.
Isn't that funny? We're so spoiled here in America, in the U.S. I mean, sure, you are made to take a second language once you get to, you know, middle school or high school, but in other countries, English is just a natural language to learn alongside whatever your native language is. It's amazing. It's amazing. I can't, the sad part of that is that my mother didn't make us speak to her back in Filipino or in Visayan. So I can understand everything she says. So if we're out and about and she wants to talk, you know, about some people that are around us, she'll talk to me in Cebuano. And I'll understand every word she says. It's just hard for me to speak it back. I'd have to like think really hard to speak it back to her.
Because we're talking about conversations with mom, we're going to jump ahead here to, I want to know the types of conversations you had with your mom once you and Sean learned of his diagnosis. And of course, after he passed.
Well, we have a large, wonderful family between Sean and I. So we made the calls right away. I called his parents first and then his brothers. And then, of course, I called my mom and dad. And no, I think I called Sean's parents and then my parents. And then I said, you know, let me get through this. Give everyone else a call and I'll call you back. My mom and dad, my stepdad, who I believe is my birth father reincarnated, was just, they're amazing. And we're extremely close. And so when I gave them that call, I just gave them the bullet points and they immediately said, we're booking a flight, we're coming. they sold our house in Hawaii, which really made me sad. And they decided to retire in Wilmington, North Carolina, or right outside of Wilmington. So they went from a beach area to a different beach, different coast. I know.
Why? Mom and Dad, what are you doing?
I know. My stepdad, we met when I was about, I want to say I was 13 or 12. And he is, like I said, my birth father reincarnated. And he worked for United Airlines. And so we were able to travel and, you know, living in Hawaii. So that helped really expand my world. But United took away his flying benefits. And so they settled with them for some amount. And so it just wasn't feasible for them to live in Hawaii and then have to travel. Just was cost prohibitive. So
right.
That's why they moved to North Carolina. Yeah. So back to your question. I'm so sorry. Okay. So I called my mom and dad. I finally called them back after I made all the other calls with the family. And we talk every day. So it's not like it was a huge, huge surprise to them that, you know, something was happening. I had already been communicating with them about my suspicions with Sean. Of course, we never dreamt in the world it would be terminal, incurable brain cancer at that point. But
now when you say like suspicions, said, sorry to cut you off. When you say suspicions, what you talk about headaches and things like that. What were some of the signs that tipped you off to even go to the doctor to begin with?
Yeah, it was really... Gus was 3 years old at the time, and Sean and I had not been really on a vacation since he was born. You know how it is as a parent. We were two.
Totally. I'm right there with you.
Two working parents. And so we thought, okay, he's 3 years old. I think we should take that trip finally. Let's go to Paris, which we had both never been to, that magical city. His brothers had gifted him, both of us really, for his 50th birthday, a really luxurious trip to Paris for a week. So we decided, let's do it. Let's do it this this May, end of May, I think we left to go. And my parents flew out here and they stayed home here at the house with Gus. And so it was on this trip that we were together 24/7. Before that, you know, I worked, he worked. There were some odd things that he was doing, but we could justify each one of them at the time as him turning 50. He had just started a new job and a new show. He was a writer. You know, all these things. We were parents of a toddler, so both of us were tired, forgetful, and things like that. So by the time we got to Paris, we were together 24/7. And it was when I realized he did not plan our itinerary like he normally would. He did not wake up before I did to work out, write a few pages. He would do a million things before I did. I worked the morning show, so all I wanted to do was sleep in. So he usually was up way before me, but on this trip, he was not. He was acting very forgetful, and it was unusually extreme, even for him.
Yeah.
So every day we were there, it got progressively worse. And the real telltale sign for me was my husband was strong. He was healthy. He ate right. He exercised. And he lived in New York for many years. And when we were in Paris, he had a difficult time hailing a cab. Which New Yorker do you know would never know how to hail a cab? That was the major point for us. And so by the time we got to the end of the trip, I literally was in tears. And he even suspected something was going on. So I made him promise to see a doctor. And he said, yes, I will. We thought maybe, you know, he had some kind of thyroid or an imbalance somewhere that we could fix. You know, of course, we never dreamt it would be incurable.
Want to ask about your Google experience at that point, because Google can either be your friend or can be the monster under the bed that you'd never want to go look at because it's going to scare you.
That's what the doctors tell you immediately. Like, don't Google this. And that, what's the first thing we do? We Google everything. We search engine everything. So it was, I have to say though, on a scale of how Google was accurate, most times, you know, we self-diagnose and we look it up right away. When we looked it up right away, it was pretty right on actually about that diagnosis.
Well, I'll throw in there that, of course, it was right on because, unfortunately, the glioblastoma that he was diagnosed with is one of the worst things you could be diagnosed with, which, generally speaking, if you're going to Google all your symptoms, you're going to immediately go to the worst. And sure enough, unfortunately, in this case, that was accurate.
Yeah, we didn't Google it until after he was diagnosed. I had no idea. You know what? On the periphery, I had heard the word glioblastoma, mainly because on the news, I work on the news, and I think I'd heard it on two occasions. One was Senator Ted Kennedy had been diagnosed of it, and he died really as a result of that, but he was much older. And then I think one other person, I can't even remember the name now, that had been diagnosed with it. So it was very foreign to me. It just didn't roll off my tongue, GBM, glioblastoma. And so we Googled it as soon as we got out of that doctor's appointment that he had. It was 2 weeks exactly after we landed from Paris. We saw doctor after doctor, which, by the way, the first two doctors told him he was totally fine. His blood work was fine. Everything was good. And then finally, he saw a neurologist, and they said, well, you know, you have a little bit of depression naturally from all of the, you know, the symptoms that he was suffering from. So that doctor sent him to get a brain MRI just to see if he had had clinical depression or something like that. And it was there that the technician saw the tumors and immediately called his doctor. I remember him, he went to get the MRI in the morning. And I think he got a call from the doctor to say, get over to St. John's Brain Surgery Center right away, ASAP, like a few hours later.
Wow. Wow. We're going to be bouncing all over the place because things you talk about, you know, you experience growing up are going to relate to things that, you know, you talk about with your husband and talk about with Gus, and things that relate to, you know, things that I went through with my wife and our daughters. So if anybody's listening to this, I shouldn't say if anybody, as people are listening to this, we're going to be bouncing around a lot because that's just life, right? You know, one thread leads to another. So I want to go back to Hawaii And because I do want to spend a lot of time on the book and a lot of time with you and Sean and Gus, but I do want to talk about how you got to Los Angeles, because you're in Hawaii, you go to the University of Hawaii. At what point did you decide you wanted to be in news? And mm-hmm. without coming to Los Angeles, there is no you and Sean and Gus.
This is true. This is 100% true. Look, I have, you know, a little bit of my about my life. And in Hawaii, my parents, they helped me so much throughout my brother and I, both of us, and even my older brother, my stepbrother as well. When I was 17, I was in high school and I had a boyfriend that I thought I fell in love and thought he was the man for me for the rest of my life. And even though we practiced safe sex, I found myself pregnant at 17. And so I was scared naturally. My parents were there to help us. And so we're extremely close. I learned so much from being a teen mom. My boyfriend at the time, we got married and we decided to move as far away as we could from my parents and both of our parents. And so we lived in Germany for a few years. Then I realized I shouldn't have been married. So I moved back to Hawaii. We were kids. We were young punks.
What's with this family and just leaving Hawaii for vastly, vastly different environments?
I know. It's fun. It's an adventure. And boy, trust me, I did have a different perspective and a deeper appreciation for Hawaii when I moved back that time from living in Germany for a while. But you asked the question about how I got into news. So I moved back to Hawaii, and that was when I went back to college. And I had a young toddler in tow sometimes. You know, I'm so grateful for my teachers at Leeward Community College and University of Hawaii, because there were a few times where I had to bring Desmond, my older son, to class with me because, I don't know, some reason for his school, preschool, whatever. But here I was, super young. And I discovered and remembered what I wanted to do when I was older. When I was a young girl in the Philippines, I would run home and turn on the box. I used to call it this box when I was a kid. You know, back then, it was the television. And I used to watch Sesame Street obsessively as a young girl. And there was a character on the show. Her name was Maria. She was dark. She was brown like I was. She had dark hair. And I thought, oh my gosh, I want to do what they are doing. I want to do what she's doing, which was to really make me happy. I was excited. I loved the content they were creating. And so I think at an early age, 5 years old, maybe I was, I realized that I wanted to do that. So I didn't remember that until I went back to college and deciding on what to do, because every Filipino family wants their daughter to either be a nurse or a doctor or a dentist or, you know. So when my parents brought that up to me, I said, well, you know, I don't know. So I remember I interned at the hospital for a few days and I said, oh, no, that's not for me. I cannot do that. And I remembered my passion and love for the television. So I fell upon the journalism program at Leeward Community College. They were producing a television show at the time. And I thought, what are you doing here? What can I help? And so that's really where it started. I started reading the news for Leeward Community College and then told people about what I wanted to do, which is what I encourage everyone to do. And I met a producer for the local television news and got me in. And he said, we're looking for a weather girl. I said, and you know, of course, I went back to school, got my meteorology certification. So I became a meteorologist. And that's how I fell into news.
So you start working in KHNL in Honolulu. Did you think at that point, okay, I'm just going to stay in Hawaii? The last time I left Hawaii, here we are back, you know, on the islands. So what was your goal at that point?
I was really happy working in Hawaii. My parents moved to California. So they kind of messed up my whole plan there. So off they go. They moved to Orange County, California. And of course, you know, that meant something else to me. And then I thought, oh, what if we move there too? You know, they wanted us to move, of course, with them. But here I had this job at Hawaii News 8. And so my world expanded again. And I thought, oh, to work in Los Angeles would be such a dream. but there's no way I could ever do that. And in fact, I won't name any names, but there were a couple of people that I worked with in Hawaii at the TV station who said, Maria, just stay here in Hawaii. That is so competitive there. I don't, you know, if you get an agent, maybe, but they just, you're staying in Hawaii. They basically discouraged me from that dream. And you know what? I didn't listen to that. Of course, my parents, my mom especially, she's like, da, 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 da. Just move to the NBC station here in LA. I said, sure, let me give Fritz Coleman a call.
Right,
and
right.
Let me just snap my fingers. So my mom said, yes, do it. So I remember we came to visit them in Orange County. Do you know what I did? I called Fritz Coleman. When you're young, you don't have any fear, I think. And so I had the balls. Can I say that here?
You
on
can
your
say
podcast?
That here. Balls, yeah, yes, that's fine.
Yeah, so I somehow found his number. And I gave him a call and he called me back and he was so kind.
Fritz
and
is great.
Generous.
He is so good.
Yeah. I was really surprised. And he said, come on, I'll take you on a tour. And so we did. We went there. We went to see Jay Leno. He took us on a tour and Fritz was really amazing. I don't know if he'll remember that at all, even remember me, but I really appreciated that. And
I have him coming up on the podcast in the next couple of months. So I'll ask him about that.
I don't know if he'll remember. This is back in 1997, I think. I hope he knows or will know how wonderful he was to me and really inspired me. So I remember going back home to Hawaii after that visit. And here's what else happened. A viewer sent me a letter. Do you remember back in the days when people wouldn't send you an email or a text or a Twitter tweet? Someone actually wrote a letter and sent it to me in Hawaii. And it was from a viewer who lived here in California, happened to be vacationing in Hawaii with his family, and said, I have the letter somewhere. I saved it. And he said, you know what? I just saw your broadcast. I realized that you're new. I think it was early on when I first started working at the KHNL. And he said, you should really check into this woman who has now become an agent at Ken Lindner Agency. Her name is Karen Wang. And I saved that article. There was a little news article of Karen Wang Lavelle, whom I love dearly as well. So I showed it to my friends in Hawaii that I worked with, and they're like, oh no, that's a super top agency. They're not going to take you. I tried. They're not going to take you. And I thought, again, with the guys.
The discouragement. Come on, guys. Come on.
There are a lot of people like that. And I know you speak to your students over there at CSUN and all the young people that you speak to about a career in journalism. And I always tell them too, don't ever listen to other people. If you've got a dream inside of you, you keep going. You keep doing it and you keep going because people are going to try to discourage you. But you need to do it. You work hard and you do it. So here's what I did. I wrote her a letter anyway. And I'm sorry. Let me back up. I did not write a letter because I was discouraged. So I'm the perfect example of what not to do at that time. So,
because you're just starting out, you're just starting out. The confidence is not there. You're like, okay, let me defer. These are the veterans. They know what they're talking about. What do I know?
What do I know? So I put that letter away. Now, meanwhile, my mother is still convincing me to move to California. She discovers a news station in Orange County called the Orange County News Channel, OCN. And she goes, what about here then? If you can't go and work with Fritz, why don't you work here at OCN?
If you can't go work with Fritz. I love that part.
She goes, go work for OCN then. And I said, oh, okay. So I called the news director over there. And he's talking to me and he said, send me your tape. So I sent him a tape. He called me back and he said, yeah, come in. When are you coming back to LA to visit? And I said, actually, I'm going to be there next month. He goes, come in to the office and I'll sit and talk with you. And so I sat in his office and he offered me a job. I was like, what? Really? Is this for real? So he offered me a job. He said, I'll promise me I'll help you move over here. And they did. They gave me some money to move to California, me and my son. And he said, but you got to promise me 2 years. I said, okay, sure. Of course. Because I don't want you to ask to leave before the 2 years is up. And he knew. So I started working at OCN. About 3 months after I started working at OCN, guess who calls me and leaves me a message on my voicemail? Karen Wang Lavelle.
Bam.
Yeah, she got married. Yeah, she called me. So interesting how life works. And I showed her the article, of course. And we were together for a while. And she was very instrumental in me getting a job here at Fox.
Did she say how she ended up contacting you? Did that same viewer contact her and say, hey, by the way, I wrote this woman a letter back in Hawaii X number of years ago. Now she's here in Orange County. You should totally go after her.
That would have been really an amazing story if that happened. What happened was Ken Rudolph, who also worked with me at OCN, she represented him. And he, I guess, said to her, hey, we've got a new meteorologist here. You should check her out. Karen was someone who really wanted to push representation. And I love her so much for that. And there were few females of color, certainly people of color on television at that time. And so she saw me, grabbed me right away. And I was so fortunate and so happy to be represented by her. And then met the news director at KCOP at the time. I went up there for an interview and he offered me a job as well, which so fortunate and so lucky. But you know what we say about being lucky. You work hard at being lucky, right? You work hard at being ready at the right time. And so I'd like to pat myself.
I want to go back to that promise, though. You made 2 years. Did you stay the 2 years?
It was about 1 month shy of the 2 years.
All right, that's fine then. That's fine.
He let me go. Yeah.
That's cool. At least, because I've got former students who, they go to their first market, same as your first market. Granted, it was Orange County, but your first market said, hey, promise me 2 years. Give me a couple of years. 6 months later, 9 months later, they either realize that either this is not for them, get a job offer at a bigger market.
Get a better offer.
Yeah. And the small markets, they know that they're going to get poached. And it's just part of the business. It's just part of the business. And I just try to talk to as many students as possible about not burning bridges with those early markets, because you just never know.
Yeah.
I want to go back because you mentioned the representation side of things. Did you start with Channel 11 or at 13 first?
I was at 13 first, KCOP.
Okay. So you were watching Sesame Street growing up, and the only representation you felt like maybe you saw at the time was on Sesame Street. So you have anybody growing up, whether it was in the Philippines or Hawaii, I totally can do that? Or was it really just kind of limited to Sesame Street?
You know what? It was Sesame Street for most of that. And then when I was in Hawaii, of course, I was so fortunate to live in a state that embraced all cultures and ethnicities. And on television, we were represented. There were many people that looked like me on television at that time. There was Emmy Tamimbong. I can name her. She definitely stood out for me. There were several actually at the time. And so I appreciated that. Now, moving to the mainland is what we would call, right? The US, or every time I would visit or just watch network television, there wasn't that representation. And I knew that. And I saw that. And so when my parents moved to California, I did have that in the back of my mind as well. And I thought, this is a good opportunity to bring diversity and be a representative of Filipino Americans, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders. And I hope that I can do my share to encourage other people to do what we do.
How did you meet Sean? Because he just had his birthday a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, March 11th. That was all over your Instagram. It was so beautiful. So beautiful. The tributes coming in.
Thank you. That was especially hard. For some reason, this was an especially hard year. I mean, of course, part of it was the pandemic and the fact that we're so isolated from other people. But this was a particularly hard one for me. Okay, how we met. Before I met Sean, I had two divorces by that time. I don't have boyfriends, apparently, at that time. I just got married.
All right, I think we found our promo clip there.
I learned my lesson, though, Aaron. Like, I didn't need to be married again. So when I met Sean, I was very happily single. And I kind of, you know, I was looking, but not really. It was fine. It was a colleague of mine who suggested that I join her and her boyfriend at the time, who became her husband, for a dinner party that they were having. And she said, you should really come, Maria. There's someone there that's going to be there that I think you should meet. I said, really? Yeah. And apparently Sean was getting the same thing from his brother, who was the boyfriend of my co-anchor at the time. And so it was kind of a setup, if you will. And I didn't want to go by myself because it was going to be a dinner of couples at first. And I guess they were expecting Sean and the rest of the family to come after the dinner. And so our other co-anchor, John Beer, some of you may know and remember John Beer. So we were in the makeup room, or and Lauren's trying to talk me into going to their dinner party. And I said, I don't want to go by myself. So then in comes John, and Lauren goes, John, what are you doing Saturday night? He goes, I don't know. What are we doing? What are we doing? So I said, great, John, you be my date. We're going to go to this dinner. So we went to this dinner, and Sean and I almost never, we almost didn't meet because he didn't come until the very end. Him and his other brothers, they were actually celebrating another brother's birthday that night. And so we were almost getting ready to leave, but they walk in and Sean makes a beeline to me. Obviously he had seen the news before, I think. And he said, hello. And I remember they were taking photos at this party. And so it was, I think, at the moment after we shook hands, there was this photo taken of us. And Sean's brother, Patrick, gifted that photo to us, surprised us with this photo. I didn't even know it existed until the night before we got married. And he told this really funny story, how they tried so hard, it took them forever to crop John out because John was in the picture. It was John, me, and Sean. And so I guess I just, like, you know, forgot all about John once Sean walked into the room. So yeah, that's how we met. That was in 2003. And yeah, we had been together pretty much ever since then.
7 years later, along comes Gus. Tell me about the name Gus. That is not a 2010 name.
Okay, I personally like to say that Gus was named after St. Augustine. We have a very strong faith, and we have a family here at our Catholic Church. And so we like to say St. Augustine was the inspiration for Gus's name. Now, if anyone knows Sean very well, they will know that Gus was named Gus because Sean's favorite basketball player of all time was Gus Williams, who played for the Supersonics. And so, and so anyway, that's the story that, that's been going around about Gus.
Yeah, because there are a lot of kids who share their names with classmates. I'm guessing that Gus is the only Gus in almost all of his classes.
He's the only one for sure in his class. I think we've met one other Gus in, I don't know, two years older than him at his school. But there are very few Gus's around at this time in the world. They should bring that back. That's a strong name. That's a good, strong name, Gus.
Take us then, if you can, to the middle of 2014.
That was when we got the official diagnosis that he had this terminal, incurable brain cancer. They found the tumors. They sat us down and showed us the MRI images. And that was the day that our lives really changed forever. Yeah.
We talked about you calling your parents, his parents. What was the conversation like for you two?
That's a really good question. I think we were in disbelief at first when we heard those words come out of the doctor's mouth. And I remember initially we saw the one doctor walked in and he said all these words. And I think we had this look on our faces like the deer in the headlights. And so he stopped and said, wait a minute, did your personal doctor not talk to you about this? And he said, no. So he said, okay, hold on. So he leaves the room. And Sean and I are just sitting there and we're dumbfounded. I think we were just so shocked. And we couldn't even talk about it. I think we were just really silent and quiet. And then I think I said, well, we'll fix it. you know, we'll get it out. We're very solution oriented people anyway. Sean is so positive. He's always so positive. And so the other doctors walked in. That was when we knew it was really serious. You know, when several of them come into this little tiny room and they really outlined for us what they were seeing on these scans. And of course they couldn't know for sure until the biopsy. They had scheduled a biopsy like 2 days later. It was that serious. And they had already suspected just by looking at it that it was GBM. And so we walked out of that office and I remember it was a cold, I had my sweater on, it's all in the book, and I was shivering. And Sean, I remember this so clearly, we walked out of that room and he just started crying. And I remember going to him to hug him, and the nurse pulled me back and she said, let's give him a moment. And he kind of sunk into this little alcove. And the nurse took that opportunity to talk to me. And she said, listen, and she gave me her cell phone number. And she said, you're going to have to be strong now. You are going to have to be the stronger one. And this, I'm not going to lie to you, this disease is a tough one. And I'm sorry. It kind of was like a slap in my face a little bit. And she just hugged me, you know, she hugged me and said, be strong now. And I said, okay. And I collected Sean. He came out of the alcove and we held each other for dear life. I remember my hands were red. He was holding my hand so tight. And he kept saying, I'm sorry. He just kept saying that to me. And I said, honey, there's nothing for you to be sorry about. This is not your fault. And we're gonna fix it. We're gonna fix this. And so we had every positive energy and we were ready to fight that battle. So we got in our cars and I said, I'll make the calls and you, I was scared actually. I said, I'm going to follow you because he could have had a seizure at any time, the doctor said. And so, we went home. And as soon as we got home, I think his brothers came one by one. They were there for us the entire way. And their wives and his parents, our whole family, our friends. I just love them so much. Yeah.
My box of tissues is in the other room. It's in the other room.
I wish I could give you mine.
I know. I'm just gonna use my sleeve. So obviously the biopsy confirmed what the doctors had feared and suspected. What was the timeline? What was their
We asked that. We said, okay, what are we looking at here? Give it to us plain. And they said, okay, if you do nothing, you'll have about 3 months to live. If you do the standard of treatment, which is the same, it has been the same for so long, so many years, it's, you know, radiation, chemo, then moving on to experimental clinical trial drugs. They said, if that works for you, you could have anywhere from 12 to 14 months. There are some lucky few who get several years, but I can count them on one hand, I think, for those people. So we looked to the few people that can survive and beat this thing. And that's where we decided we were going to be. We were going to be in that camp. And so Sean said, let's do it. Let's do everything. And I took my cues from him. And we said we're gonna take advantage of what was out there for us. And so he went through some harrowing treatments, and he's an incredible warrior. He had to do radiation on his head twice a day. Most people can really only do it once a day, and he did it twice a day. He had a very aggressive treatment schedule.
Was that for 2 weeks or was that continuous?
It was for a month.
Oh my goodness.
Well, he did it. He did it for 4 weeks the first time. And then when he got a regrowth, he was able to do it, withstood it a second time. And I really thought I was going to lose him even during that first time. He lost so much weight and was really suffering those side effects, but he did it. He did. He fought through. And he had a lot to live for. You know, he would always say, I have you and Gus, and I'm going to live as long as I can. And so that's what we did.
My wife's diagnosis in late 17, it was, I mean, really, it was probably stage 4 breast cancer because there was some lymph node involvement, but they called it stage 3. It was just, it was a lump in her right breast. And because she's was so young and it was so aggressive, they recommended, and she ended up getting a double mastectomy. And yeah. So chemo and radiation for almost all of 2018 into the summer. 2019 was a healthy year, relatively speaking. And then early 2020, she didn't even have any symptoms, but because it had been a few months since a blood test, maybe 6 months since testing for the markers, she asked her oncologist, "Hey, can we run some numbers here?" And sure enough, those markers were skyrocketing. It was a wonder actually that she didn't have any symptoms because it had spread to her lungs, liver, adrenals, and bone by that point.
Wow.
So we got on this experimental immunotherapy drug.
Yeah.
Because we thought, okay, there are no symptoms. This would be probably a good opportunity to try this out and help, you know, obviously her immune system is working to this point to suppress the symptoms. Let's try to help it out. That was January, February, but by May, it was clear that it was not helping. And she ended up in the hospital in May. At one point, even got amnesia. Woke up one morning, had no idea how old she was. Had trouble answering questions just about the girls' ages. And then in June, by June, she needed oxygen 24/7, had a Plurix catheter inserted to drain the fluid from her lungs. That was such a painful procedure. She was actually in the hospital for 10 days because then her white blood cell count just dropped. And because it was during the pandemic, zero visitors. So it was just a miserable, depressing, on top of the cancer treatment and the way that was making her feel, it was just a miserable, depressing feeling, experience. And so she actually didn't, while she probably should have gone back into the hospital at some point between that time in June and when she eventually went back into the hospital for the last time in November, she probably should have gone back into the hospital a few times. But because it was such a miserable experience, she just refused. She just refused. And then finally, election night. Oh, and so we go to the summer, and this is one of the reasons I was asking you about the radiation that your husband went through, because over the summer, when she was getting traditional chemotherapy, because she could not handle the chemotherapy pills that she was trying to take, she was developing this neuropathy in her fingers and toes, which was not unusual. That happened also in 2018, but also now this time around her mouth. And super tingly feeling, you know, her tongue always felt like she had just sipped on something super hot and it burned her tongue. And her doctors feared that it was neurological, that it wasn't just a side effect of the chemotherapy. And so we went in for an MRI, and sure enough, it had actually spread to her brain by that point. Innumerable lesions, to the point where they said, okay, well, we can do what's called stereotactic, which is we can just try to get each lesion, but that's generally reserved for the number of lesions being like 3 to 10. You have three or four times that.
Oh my gosh.
So,
Your wife is a warrior too. That's
big time.
That's incredible. Incredible.
And so she, you know, we had to get off chemo at that point because now she's got to go for whole brain radiation for a couple of weeks. And I mean, the doctors were great and everything, you know, she was scheduled to go back about 3 months later to check to see how the treatment went, because you know you don't see anything right after the radiation, so say come back in 3 months. But by this point, you know, there was the liver involvement, and the liver is where all of this stuff tries to get filtered out, and her liver just couldn't handle it. And so by the time November came around, actually election night, the week before election night, her doctors called her because she had come in for some blood work, and they said, can you come in today for emergency chemo, basically, because her bilirubin was, you know, off the charts,
bro. Yeah.
And they said, okay, well, and this is, again, these are the things that you learn only when you're thrust into it.
I just was going to say that you're throwing around these terms that I haven't heard or said in a long time, and it's just coming, like, flooding back.
Yeah. 2 years ago, I wouldn't have known any of these terms. A year and a half ago, wouldn't have known any of these terms. And now I'm talking to the doctors about, well, what's her Billy? You know, what's the Billy number? What about the WBC? Yeah. What about the you know? Yeah. And so they basically gave her this emergency chemotherapy in the hopes that it would calm down the liver.
Suppress it. Yeah.
And the thing is with chemotherapy, it's like the only way you can stop cancer in the liver is with chemotherapy. But the problem is once the cancer gets so bad, it can't handle the chemo. And right. And that's right. Basically what happened. And so we went in on election night, and a week later she stopped breathing. She had a procedure to drain the fluid from her lungs, thoracentesis. And because she was in such bad shape by that point, it created some internal bleeding, and it just, you know, it's a lot like what you write in the book about you telling Gus, is the idea that her body just could not fight anymore.
Yeah, I can imagine the conversations that you were having with your daughters, and they're young too. I think they're younger. Are they like 6 and
yeah, 6
seven?
And 8. Yeah, 6 and 8 now, but it was 5 and 8.
They were even younger. Yeah.
Yeah. I should mention, Maria had to take just a quick little break. If, as you're listening to this, you're wondering where did all the tears go and everything, we had a couple moments to just kind of collect ourselves, which I think was very necessary. One of the things that you mentioned was Sean was a warrior. My wife was a warrior, and she had honest conversations with our daughters about what was happening. She was clear with them. Mommy's sick. She would, when she had the double mastectomy and when she went through treatment then, she would show them the scars. She would show them the wounds. She would talk about, like, well, I'm sorry you can't lay next to mommy tonight because I just had a PET scan and I'm radioactive for the next 24 hours. So wow. You know, there were conversations that she started and kept going that I would have never thought to have had, because I feel like I came from the mindset of protecting children from the pain instead of trusting that they can handle it if the conversation is set up for success in that aspect.
You know, this is one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I mean, there are many reasons why I wrote the book. First and foremost, I don't know if we talked about this earlier, but I wanted to just quickly say we were no different from many people. I'm sure you asked these same questions when Sean was diagnosed. You know, we said, why, God? Why this? Why us? Why so severe? What, we try to be good people. We go to church. We try to help. You know, we're healthy. He was a healthy person. He ate right. He exercised, you know, did all these things. And so we couldn't help but realize that I wore a microphone every day. He was a writer by profession. And we thought, this is a disease that gets very little funding. This is a disease that haven't even had any advancements in the treatments just to keep you alive, you know? So not only is it incurable. So we thought, you know, maybe we're supposed to help shine a light on this disease. Maybe we're supposed to do our part. This is part of our purpose. And so Sean and I made a pact to write something about our story about this disease. He was supposed to write it. We never gave up hope that he was going to beat this thing, right, even until the end. So we both agreed that we should write a story, our story. And I didn't even remember that until a year after he passed, 1 year after the anniversary of his death. And then I was reminded about that pact that we had. So I started writing the book. That was in 2017. And I talked about this with our therapist. And hopefully this book will help other people. Part of this book talks about how we talk to Gus about the diagnosis. And I know you mentioned, you know, your wife. Most people want to protect their children. They want to shelter them from the pain and the ugliness of this disease. But, you know, the rule of thumb, what our therapist taught us, is that if your child is old enough to ask a question, they're old enough to hear the answer. Of course, in the age-appropriate language. And that's why I am so grateful and thankful for our therapist, our personal family therapist, and also Lauren Schneider, who contributed to the book that I wrote here. Because when you talk about a disease to your child, you want to try to avoid words like sick, because children associate being sick then with death and dying. And so we didn't want to do that with Gus. So we made sure to tell him that Daddy was not sick. Daddy had a cancer diagnosis. He had a disease that Mommy did not have and that he did not have. So we were very careful about how we spoke to him about what was going on. We were very honest with him. After every doctor's appointment, we came home. We did not try to hide what the results were when the treatments weren't working. We told him, you know what? We just got back. We didn't get really great news about the cancer because it's still growing, but we're going to do this. Doctors are trying to do this. And so the therapist really helped me find the language, Sean and I both, to tell Gus what was happening at the time. She helped us talk about death and what to expect and how people die. So Gus had a very clear understanding about the physiology and the science behind how someone dies. You know, we talked to him about how your heart stops beating when you die. And when your heart stops beating, you stop breathing, and, you know, and it's just your body. So he really understood that. And so there was no fear or confusion about the disease and who had it and who didn't have it. So that's in the book. And I don't know where I was going with this, but I hope that the book can help you, even if you did not suffer through brain cancer, because Lauren takes every part of our journey and extrapolates from that, makes it very universal, and helps you, whether it's brain cancer or a loss of some sort, and how to talk to your children. And I'm a big advocate for professional help, mental help. And I recommend therapy for everyone, even if you don't have anything wrong in your life necessarily. You know, we all go to the dentist twice a year. We go to the doctor. I think we should at least go at least twice a year to see someone for our mental health. I think it's really important.
Yeah. And if there was ever any question in my mind as to what my daughters could handle, there were two things that really kind of stand out. And that's, my wife had a conversation with them late in the summer about whether they want mommy to be buried or cremated. Mm-hmm. The girls made the decision that mommy should be cremated and kept here at home.
Wow.
That was a conversation that I would have never even thought to have with the girls. I mean, she and I could talk about that, but she initiated that conversation with them. And
that's wonderful.
Taking her lead, when my wife stopped breathing on Tuesday, November 10th, they did life-saving procedures there in the hospital. I was with her in the hospital because UCLA Santa Monica actually allowed a visitor in that unit, in the oncology unit. I'm so grateful for them. And she was in the ICU the next day. And it was clear, because she had already had two heart attacks by that point, that the next one was she was not going to be able to recover from that. And so on that Wednesday, we had the option, should the girls come up into the ICU and say goodbye? And most of the doctors and nurses advised against it.
Really?
You know, just because traditionally ages 5 and 8, you don't necessarily take them into the hospital so they can see mommy like that. But I tried my best to try to channel what she would have done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I brought them up.
Yeah.
They could say goodbye. They could touch her, talk to her, tell her they love her. And they had everybody was so sweet. They had a pediatrics nurse come over and help them take her fingerprints and put them in little keychains and lockets. And they aren't left wondering what happened to mommy. They aren't left wondering what did she look like? What was the room like? You know, I talked to them in the chapel downstairs beforehand. I said, okay, when we go upstairs, it might be a little bit scary because we've got a lot of machines and they're helping keep mommy alive right now, but she can probably hear you. And even if she can't, she's with us. She can hear you, you know, and it doesn't matter until, you know, after she dies. Like right now, we talk to her every day. We talk to her every day.
So do we. That's so wonderful to hear, Aaron. So do we. So we talk to Sean all the time. And it's interesting that you bring that point up, because in the book I write about how I made the decision not to wake Gus up.
Right.
When Sean died, and he was very angry with me about that. He let me know it too. And we were in a session with our therapist, and I asked him to forgive me. And I said that I was sorry that I didn't, but I made that decision based on what the information I had at the time. It was in the middle of the night, and he had some questions, and he forgave me. And so I think when we're faced with that, you know, we make decisions just based on how we're feeling at the moment. And for you, that was the right decision. And for me at the time, that was the right decision. But I think the lesson for me is that through all of that, that you're able to communicate with your young kids and tell them, you know, what's happening. And I applaud you for that. And that, I think you're great, great dad.
It helps them trust that they can feel what they want to feel. We cry together. We talk to her. We talk about what's going on. If daddy said, I tell them daddy said, and this is why I'm sad. And it lets them know that they can be sad and talk to me about it too. The more that we can trust our kids to handle things, the more they can handle.
They are amazing, aren't they? They know so much and they are so whip smart, and you can't pull anything on them. They totally see right through us, right? So we have to be honest with them. And I tell Gus and all the time, like, if, you know, I cry because this is back when he was younger, you know, because he'll look at me, you know, at times when I would cry. And I said, remember what we talked about with Betsy? And he'd say, yeah. If we don't cry, we'll get a tummy ache, and I don't want to get a tummy ache. And so I actually had a moment yesterday. Yesterday was particularly difficult for me, and I came home and I was in tears. I was crying. And I don't know what it was exactly that triggered it. And I'm sure you can relate. And you know, in the coming years, maybe this conversation will come back to you and how just certain things around can trigger that loss and our sadness and our grief. And for me, it was yesterday, really, really hard. I remember I was crying in front of Gus and he looked very concerned. And I reminded him, I said, remember, if I don't cry, I'm going to get a tummy ache, so I got to let it out. You know. And so he got it and he remembered. And we shared some laughs after. And yeah. Also too, back to the book, it's a sense of purpose for me to have to write it. And my heart is broken into a million pieces, as I know yours is. And this book, every time someone says that it has helped them in some way, it just heals my heart. Sitting here talking to you about it, as sad as I am to remember back to those moments, I'm very grateful for those moments that we had. And I hope that by sharing my story, your story, that it can help other people somehow and just know that they're not alone. It does heal my heart. And I thank you for helping to heal my heart today, Aaron. Thank you.
I can't let you go without finding out whose idea it was to get you on TikTok. And is it you or Gus coming up with the different dances and videos?
Oh my gosh, TikTok has been our saving grace.
Isn't it great? I mean, seriously, it's something that parents and kids can do together, have fun together.
Yeah.
I love it.
It really truly is. I mean, it started as sort of something so bad and we were all kind of afraid of TikTok for, you know, well, like, oh no.
Any new social media, especially one where you can be as vulnerable as TikTok lets you, it encourages vulnerability, and I love that.
Here's the thing for us, and TikTok means different things for different people. And for us, I know Gus is so competitive and I'm competitive too, to a degree. So there are these dance challenges and trends on TikTok that we want to master because we're so competitive. So I think that's part of the reason why we get into these dance challenges, the lip sync challenge. It's like, okay, how close can we get saying those words and having it match? So those are the things that we're doing, and it helps me get him off the video games.
Yep.
And he goes outside with me begrudgingly. He's like, I don't want to do this TikTok. But
once he gets into it, it's,
yes. But eventually he has a great time. We end up laughing so much. And then at the end of it, we've created a video memory of that moment. So it's a kind of a win-win.
I love watching you two interact on that. It's great. It's so good. It's so good. Of course, I'll put it all in the show notes, you know, all the links to all your social media and everything like that. Maria, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. We have more to talk about. We should have another podcast soon.
We absolutely will.
Because there's all this other stuff. Oh, I got to share with you. You know, for me, it's been over 5 years. Sometimes it feels like 5 months, but a lot has gone on, and we'll do that on the next talk.
Okay? For sure.
Thank you. Much love.
All of Maria's links are in the show notes, including her social media, at Maria's Earth, and a link to buy her book, You Can't Do It Alone, A Widow's Journey Through Loss, Grief, and Life After. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Aaron Bender, on Facebook and TikTok at Aaron Bender Media. Invite you to like the Aaron Bender Podcast Facebook page. All my links are at aaronbender.com. Thank you so much for listening. And if you have guest ideas or comments, email me, aaronbendermedia@gmail.com. Be well.